It is 3 o'clock. We're starting an hour late, but we are going to have now our opening prayer from Psalm 72, verses 18 and 19. Blessed be the eternal God, the God of Israel, who only does wondrous things, and blessed be his glorious name forever, and let the whole earth be filled with his glory. Amen and amen. וברוך שם כבודו לעולם, וימלא כבודו את כל הארץ. אמן ואמן. Good afternoon. Shabbat shalom. Maybe you were able to catch a quick siesta while we were dealing with our issues here. We were supposed to start at 2 o'clock. It is now 3 o'clock in the east. It's noon out west. We're spoiling your lunch. I'm so sorry. I hope you can have a festive Sabbath luncheon after the services, and I hope that the spiritual food will be as delicious or more so than your physical food later. So thanks for your patience. And of those of you who forgot that we started 2, you're on time today. But we'll try to keep the 2 o'clock starting time normally. We will try to start it at 2. So we have started an hour late. So those of you who think you're on time today, who thought it was at 3, you're on time only today. The video camera that we normally use chose to die, and the Apostle Paul was not here to resurrect it. When it comes to human beings, you know, they say that righteous people die on Shabbat, but I don't know if good machines conk out on Shabbat or not. I think bad machines conk out on Shabbat when we're trying to get a service out to everybody, right? You know, at one time, I had to move from Southern California to the rural Northeast Texas, and many of my friends moved along with me. Then later on, we went back for a visit to Southern California, and one of our friends from Southern California who was living with us in Northeast Texas said to us, when you go back to Southern California, walk into Trader Joe's and kiss the floor for me. She really missed Trader Joe's. Well, now you Southern Californians can know, if you were wondering about whether you could move out here or not, we have Trader Joe's here now. It opened yesterday in Winter Park, a very nice area of the Orlando metropolitan region. And at the opening, Daniel and Megan were there. They bought out the place. No, I doubt that, but they were there. So a little more of civilization, I guess, comes to growing Central Florida, up and coming area. And it's nice to be here and to be able to serve you from here. And I hope that a lot of you will be with us in the autumn here. And I hope we can be with a lot of you in Southern California in the spring. I'm already putting out feelers. We're seriously considering, last spring, we were in Northern California and we had our activities in the city of Concord. We hope that next year during the Days of Unleavened Bread, we can do so in Southern California where many of you listen. But for the immediate future, the autumn festival season, we'll be hosting it here in Central Florida. Today I'm going to talk for about an hour, and all I'm going to do is one thing. A comment about the future of the church. Well, I'll put it a little more specifically. A comment about the future of God's church. How about that? That sounds a little better. I'm not going to define God's church today. I do believe I'm a part of it. I certainly believe that. I believe that many of you who share our beliefs and practices are therefore a part of God's church. I believe that one way to identify God's church is what do the people believe and what do they do, of course. Are they Christian commandment keepers? Then, of course, we have to specifically talk about what is a Christian, what is a commandment keeper. But I'm talking today about God's church. I'm not going to get into theology of how to define it. But if you consider yourself a member of God's church or would like to be or, you know, are looking for where to go, you know, Abraham Lincoln never found it. He knew the Bible well, and he never found a church that really he could identify with. It's understandable. But anyway, I'm going to make a comment about the future of God's church. To do that, I want to talk about the way the Bible is organized. We have a, you might call it Judeo-Christian heritage. That is to say, the church was centered in Israel. The northern tribes disappeared from history. What you had left was Judah. The Jews became, in effect, the church, the Old Testament church, and it was to the Jews that Jesus came. The Jews had a relationship with God under the Old Covenant, and they were to preserve the Holy Scriptures and the calendar that is necessary in order to observe what's in the Scriptures. The sacred calendar and the Hebrew and Aramaic Scriptures are the Jews are the custodians of those. That's an awkward sentence, but that's the Jews are the custodians of the Holy Scriptures in Hebrew and Aramaic and the sacred calendar. And some people nowadays do have a translation of the Bible. Either they have a Jewish translation along with their other Bible, or in some cases they have now what they call a Messianic Jewish Bible, which is the whole Bible translated into English, but the order of the books in the Old Testament is as a Jewish reader would find them in almost every case. Almost universally among Jews, if you open up a Bible, there's the law, the prophets, and the writings. Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim. There's the law, and there's the prophets, and then there's the hagiographa, the holy writings. And there seems to be a somewhat of a confirmation of that in the book of Luke. It's a hint rather than an absolute. But Luke, as you know, wrote under the influence, obviously, of the Apostle Paul. So even though we don't have a gospel according to Paul, we have a gospel according to Luke, who was Paul's personal physician and historian, chronicler. And in Luke 24:44, I read, and maybe you'll read along with me. Luke 24:44. Then he said to them, "These are the words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all the things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me." He mentions the law, the prophets, and the Psalms, which in most Hebrew Bibles is the first of a section of the third section of the Bible, the writings. In most Hebrew Bibles you'll come across, and this has been the case for many centuries, in most Hebrew Bibles you come across for many, many centuries, the Psalms begin the third section of the Bible. So this is at least an indication that we're dealing here with the Bible as preserved by the Hebrew-speaking community, law, prophets, and Psalms, and then the material that follows the Psalms, the third section. And it appears that Jesus was also following that order in what he had to say in Matthew 23. In any case, the book of Matthew, as you know, is a gospel written to a Jewish audience. And so in that sense, you would think that Matthew would skew his comments to the preferences of particularly the community living in what is the biblical land of Israel, Canaan, Palestine, or the biblical land of Israel. And so that you could call them Palestinian Jews. He would probably gear his comments to them. Even though he quotes basically from the Greek Bible, I'll have to say that. Matthew, as far as I understand, almost entirely quotes from the Septuagint, the Greek translation of that day. But then again, he was writing in Greek, so that would make sense. But also much of Matthew needs to be understood in a Jewish context, as we'll see later on. So keeping that in mind, I want to go now to Chronicles. Because as I said, I haven't said, I'm going to now. At the end of the Old Testament, if you have a Hebrew Bible, or if you have a Messianic Jewish Bible, you're going to come to Chronicles. That's the final sort of summary of Old Testament history. So the Bible, if you're a Hebrew speaker, or if you are part of the Jewish community, mainstream Jewish community, your Bible will end with 1st and 2nd Chronicles. That's how the order of the books goes. And it is interesting how Chronicles ties in with Matthew. And this is a case I want to make today. It's all background to the title of this talk, and I want to repeat my title. My title is, a comment on the future of God's church. And all the background you get for the next 45 minutes will just be in order for me to make the comment. But the background, I think, is very interesting to me as I've gone through it. Because I want to tell you, you know, there are two ways to look at difficulties in the Bible. You know, I guess there are two ways to look at it. One would be to sort of throw up your hands and say, you know, I can't deal with this. You know, another thing would be to say, well, I believe the Bible is infallible in terms of doctrine, but not inerrant. There may be errors in it. That's another way to look at it. A third way, which I prefer, is to respect God's word. And as a minister told me many years ago, he said, if God can create a DNA molecule, he can write a book. And so if there's something challenging in the Bible, this means you need to focus and dig in and study, and you'll probably learn a lot. In other words, the apparent contradiction will force you to dig in, and you may learn a lot. Or you may be given a lot of interesting options to think about. You know, you may not come to a complete answer, but you may come up with a lot of interesting possibilities. So rather than just, you know, fall back on assuming that the Bible is wrong, let's rather respect it and dig in and decide when we come to a challenge that we should really, in effect, analyze and work with it, and we're going to learn a lot. And I think that's the case with a certain passage I'm going to come to later. I want to first go back to 2 Chronicles 24. No, I want to go back to 2 Chronicles, the first chapter. Because the first thing I want to do is show you the link between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And you'll get this if you do have a Messianic Jewish Bible. Not that I'm recommending it. I'm not saying you shouldn't get it. I don't preach from it. But the one asset it has is that it gives you the books in the order of that you find them in a Hebrew Bible. And then it goes on to the New Testament. But it's a particular translation, and it's geared for American Jews. The translator deliberately had American Jews in mind, so he used certain idioms that American Jews tend to use that others may or may not be aware of. Anyway, let's look at Chronicles. And since it's at the end of the Bible, then now I have to orient myself because I'm using the New King James, so I have to go back and I have to go to 1 Chronicles. But notice the link between 1 Chronicles and Matthew. Okay, so I start with Chronicles. I'm at the end of the Hebrew Bible. And what's the point of Chronicles? Well, Chronicles is establishing where God is working, because we're now at the end of the Old Testament period. We're going to have a period between the Testaments. And we're going to have some religious confusion going on. We're going to have a competing religion, the Samaritan religion. And so the Samaritan religion is competing with what we might call biblical Judaism. So we have to establish where God is working. So the focus in Chronicles is on the family of David and the family of Levi, particularly Aaron, and the focus is on Jerusalem. In other words, you want to find where God is working, you go to the Levites and the priests, you go to the family of David, the monarchy of David, you go to Jerusalem. You don't go to Samaria. And, you know, I'm not down on Samaritans, but the Samaritans are not God's church. So that's in effect what's going on in Chronicles. We're establishing where to look for God, for where God is working, because as you know, John the Baptist does come finally to the Jews from the family of Aaron. Jesus comes to the Jews from the family of David. He is there in Jerusalem and crucified there. You know, so you know we're preparing for that in Chronicles at the end of the Old Testament. Everybody follow that. So first we begin to establish the whole background of human history and of Israelite history. So as we go to the book of Chronicles, it starts with genealogy. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Canaan, Mahalalel, Jared, and it goes through a genealogy. But as you keep going, you see eventually it focuses on the family of David rather quickly. In the beginning, we have, of course, general discussion of Middle Eastern peoples that were close to the Israelites. But then we finally come to the Israelitish people, and we have the sons of Jacob, but Judah is featured, because Judah was the royal family through which the Messiah would come. So we have the Middle East peoples that surrounded Israel. Then we focus on Judah. I'm in chapter 2, and already I begin to see the sons of Judah in verse 3. And then in chapter 3, I see David mentioned, so the focus is very much on David. Okay, so that's 1 Chronicles. Now, what do you suppose you're going to find if you begin the New Testament? It's as if you're still reading Chronicles. Go to Matthew. And here's the beginning of Matthew. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And then we go into the genealogy there. Where of Abraham, and then focusing on, and then I'm going to Judah, focusing on David, and then the genealogy, legal genealogy of Jesus Christ through Joseph, who was the closest thing he had to a human father, you know, Joseph. So, it's interesting how it goes. It's like, as if you're still reading Chronicles. So if you were, you know, if you were a Jewish reader, it would tie in quite well. Now, I want to go to the end of Second Chronicles, because that's the last thing you'll read before you read Matthew. So I want to go to Second Chronicles, and here we have Cyrus, who is called in the Bible a shepherd, in Isaiah the prophecies about him. Maybe that's what his name meant in his language. I think Cyrus means shepherd in one of the languages of ancient Persia. And so God calls him a shepherd in Isaiah. And Cyrus is a type of Jesus Christ. He supervises a restoration, a second exodus of exiles back into the land of Judah, and supervises the construction of the second temple. He authorizes it. Now, he wasn't there for it, but he authorized it, the rebuilding of Jerusalem and of the second temple. And so he is, in that sense, a type of Jesus Christ. And so in verse 23, as we come to the end of the Old Testament period, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth the eternal God of heaven has given me. So he is a type of Jesus Christ. Obviously, this is not the millennium, but it's a sort of a precursor. And he has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Look at what he says now. Who is among you of all his people? May the eternal his God be with him, and let him go up. And then we start the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. So it's like he's answering the call, right? Who is among you of all his people? May the eternal God, his God be with him, and may he go up. And then we have the genealogy of Jesus Christ, who went up from Nazareth to Jerusalem to become a sacrifice for us and to be resurrected from there. And he will return there. So you see the connection there between Chronicles and Matthew. And as I said, so the Old Testament in effect flows into the New and is the background. And it's the background to a very interesting passage which has a lot to say about the church and how it's treated. I'd like to go now to 2 Chronicles 24. Unfortunately, the history of the church is often a history of persecution, and often the persecution comes from rival religions, one could say. For example, the Samaritans, in effect, were a rival religion to biblical Judaism. And in the Middle Ages, there was mainstream Christianity that persecuted dissenting sects ruthlessly. And there was martyrdom. There was martyrdom also in the Jewish community. The Jews who became sectarians and became part of the sect of the Nazarenes were oppressed by their fellow Jews to the point of, in some cases, martyrdom. We have examples. The religious establishment turned Jesus Christ over to the Roman authorities for execution. Later on, Stephen was martyred. Paul was complicit. Paul, in effect, had blood in his eyes until Jesus blinded them and then gave him sight and also spiritual eyesight. And so there was martyrdom for Christians. And eventually what happened was, I haven't talked about this in quite a while. I hadn't even planned to talk about it today, but here I go. What happened in the synagogues was a prayer was added to the major prayer said in the synagogues, the 18 benedictions, the Shemoneh Esrei, the Amidah. It's called the Amidah because people said it while standing. And so the Shemoneh Esrei had an extra benediction added, which was a condemnation of the sectarians. And so this condemnation of the sectarians, if a Christian would have come into a synagogue, let's say a Christian man comes into a synagogue, and any man could lead in prayer in a synagogue. So let's say they say, hey, you know, Joe, whatever your name is. Maybe if any of you are named out there, Joe, you know, not picking on you. But hello, hey, Joe, you come up here and lead services today. Well, how is Joe going to come up and lead services when he comes to that prayer that says, you can, and may there be no hope for the sectarians, you know, which he is one. And so this was done to drive them out of the synagogue. Now later on, because the Christians became dominant and the Jews were persecuted, they changed the wording of the prayer. So now, if you go to a synagogue, they don't condemn the sectarians, they condemn the slanderers. They change the wording from sectarians to slanderers. So now, if for some reason, if you are called to lead a prayer in synagogue, you could do it. But the trouble is they're 1900 years too late or so, you know. Anyway, so we've had persecution by Jews of the sectarian Nazarenes. Then we had persecution once Christianity went Gentile, you could say, went mainstream. Then we had vicious persecution of any dissenting sects, all the way up till finally we had civil wars, you know, Protestants versus Catholics, you know, bloody battles. And that's why, of course, America established, not against religion, but against any particular official religion. That has been taken to an extreme by people who should know better. It's not a matter of the country not wanting religion, but they didn't want an establishment of religion because they didn't want to have an official church. So that means if you dissented, you were somehow less American because you're not part of the official American church, whatever it would have been, because they had this background from Europe and from England where they had come from. And even up to our own day, sad to say, we've had Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland still at odds, although that is not entirely a religious issue there. Fortunately, that's kind of calmed down compared to what's going on in the Muslim world now. Shiite versus Sunni, that is just horrific. So anyway, but as I said, to get back to the main theme, and now, frankly, mainstream Christians of all stripes, are being terribly persecuted by many Muslims, as you know. As well as, yes, by some secular governments too, such as in North Korea. I understand that that's happening as well. And to some degree in China and so on. So we do have persecution, but the point I'm making is that often it's established religions or competing religions that persecute God's church. And so they do so in the name of religion. So they think some way they're, you know, being righteous or holy by persecuting other people whose religion is different. And we'll see that as we go along. But anyway, I want to go to 2 Chronicles 24. Now, this was a very horrific period. Here we are in the 9th century B.C., and Athaliah, the daughter of Jezebel, had murdered. She was down in the south now, married to the king of Judah. And after his death, she murdered anybody who could have possibly succeeded him, any of the men who could have become king. She murdered them all, and so she became the queen of the south. You know, she became the queen of Judah, and she was idolatrous, and she was ruthless. So here we have this female tyrant running things in Judah. Well, fortunately, there was a priest named Jehoiada who saved one child who could become the heir, Joash or Jehoash. He was spared. Some people believe his name is the Eternal has given. So Jehoiada saves Joash. And when the time is right, Athaliah is executed, and the true rightful king takes the throne, Joash, but as a child. So we have, in effect, a priest as a regent ruling the country with Joash. And as Joash gets older, of course, he would do more and more on his own because he would be the king, but he had grown up under the patronage of the high priest. So we're now in chapter 24, and so we have a very positive situation. It had been very negative before. Now it became quite positive. Joash was 7 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba, or I guess you say Beersheba in English. Joash did what was right in the sight of the Eternal all the days of Jehoiada the priest, who had been like a father to him, had saved his life, and had established him as king. And all the time Jehoiada was alive, Jehoash did the right thing. And Jehoiada took two wives for him, and he had sons and daughters. Now it happened after this that Joash set his heart on repairing the house of the Eternal. So things are going very well. Then he gathered the priests and the Levites and said to them, "Go out to the cities of Judah and gather from all Israel money to repair the house of your God from year to year, and see that you do it quickly." However, the Levites did not do it quickly. So sometimes things just don't happen. There isn't the zeal that there should be. And that's why you need leadership. So the king called Jehoiada, the chief priest, and said to him, "Why have you not required the Levites to bring in from Judah and from Jerusalem the collection according to the commandment of Moses, the servant of the Eternal, and of the assembly of Israel for the tabernacle of witness? For the sons of Athaliah, that wicked woman, had broken into the house of God and had also presented all the dedicated things to the house of the Eternal to the Baals. They had taken what had been for God and dedicated it to idols. And he wanted reform. He wanted to get back on track spiritually. So his leadership pushed things to get done. Then at the king's command, they made a chest and set it outside at the gate of the house of the Eternal. And they made a proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem to bring to the Eternal the collection that Moses, the servant of God, had imposed on Israel in the wilderness." You can read about that. I believe you can read about that in Exodus. It was, you know, the half shekel that they gave. "Then all the leaders and all the people rejoiced and brought their contributions and put them into the chest until all had given. So it was at that time when the chest was brought to the king's official by the hands of the Levites, and when they saw that there was much money, that the king's scribe and all the high priest's officer, and the high priest's officer came and emptied the chest and took it and returned it to its place. Thus they did day by day and gathered money in abundance." So this was a special time in history when people were generous. People wanted to do the right thing. And periodically we have that in the South. Every once in a while a king comes along who's a righteous king and stirs up the people. And in this case he had a high priest with him, just as in some cases we find Josiah with the prophet Jeremiah with him. So we had in effect two major figures organizing this spiritual revival. And we can see its fruits in the support that was given financially to the temple. The king and Jehoiada gave it, this money, to those who did the work of the service of the house of the Eternal, and they hired masons and carpenters to repair the house of the Eternal, and also those who worked in iron and bronze to restore the house of the Eternal. So let's understand, to get the work done, it's not only preachers that get the work done, and it's not only preachers that need God's inspiration and guidance and direction. The masons needed it, carpenters needed it, and so on. So the workmen labored, and the work was completed by them. They restored the house of God to its original condition and reinforced it. When they had finished, they brought the rest of the money before the king and Jehoiada. They made from it articles for the house of the Eternal. I'm in verse 14. Articles for serving and offering, spoons and vessels of gold and silver. And they offered burnt offerings in the house of the Eternal continually all the days of Jehoiada. So, while Jehoiada lived during those early years of the reign of Joash, once he had reached adulthood, things were rolling right along. Now, Jehoiada was an unusual person. Nowadays, we have more people who are living longer. Every once in a while, I hear about somebody who has exceeded 100 years. Just recently, I heard about somebody who died at 111. You didn't hear so much about that when I was a younger child, although once in a while you did. Generally speaking, if you look at the world, 70 or 80 is how long people live. That's in Psalm 90. But there are those who live longer, and Jehoiada was quite unusual in that he lived to be 130. That's quite unique. But Jehoiada grew old and was full of days. I should say so. I'm adding. and he died. He was 130 years old when he died. And they buried him in the city of David among the kings. You see, they had great respect for him because he had done good in Israel, both toward God and his house. This is the high priest Jehoiada. Now, after the death of Jehoiada, which means the Eternal has known, it's one meaning of that, the leaders of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them. Oh, no. Bad advice. This happened also to Rehoboam, you know. He had older people who had more wisdom, but his own peers, his own generation, gave him bad advice. And he took the bad advice, and that split the kingdom. And here we go again. They came to Jehoiada, and he was so easily influenced. It's really sad how quickly things go awry, you know. It is a tragic story, and as you read the history of Israel, you have these positive periods, as I just read about. But then, now Jehoiada has died, and advisors come to him, and they are hankering for the looser times, right? The, you know, when they could, indulge themselves in some of the vices that perhaps they were now having to overcome, you know. They wanted to go back to the corrupt days of the past. It's really sad. Anyway, verse 17. Now after the death of Jehoiada, the leaders of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them. Therefore they left the house of the eternal God of their fathers and served wooden images and idols. And wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem because of their trespass. You know, when you go into idolatry, a baggage of vices follows. That's why people are attracted to it, because it gives them license to do what otherwise, you know, they would not be doing. And you're much happier when you don't do those things, but people don't get it. You know, I often think about these movies, not that I see them, but I hear about them, and they kind of glamorize really antisocial behavior. But often they don't talk about the price people pay. Once in a while, you know, they do, but often they just talk about, you know, the sinful living without showing what comes finally as a result. Or when they do show it, they don't tend to link it. Anyway, verse 19. Yet he sent prophets to them. So there were prophets at that time to bring them back to the eternal, and they testified against them, but they would not listen. And perhaps among these prophets were descendants of Jehoiada. That would seem reasonable. Now we want to talk about one here in just a moment. Well, I'll talk about him now and I'll have more to say. Then the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah. Now this is in the 9th century BC. And this is a son or grandson of the high priest Jehoiada. Then the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, the high priest, who stood above the people and said to them. So I guess he got onto a platform in some way, or onto a elevated spot. Thus says God, why do you transgress the commandments of the eternal so that you cannot prosper? In the long run, sin does bring penalties. People just don't want to connect the two together, or they try to in some ways obviate them. Like, for example, diseases can be, you know, you go to get the right medication or whatever it is. Why do you transgress the commandments of the eternal so that you cannot prosper? Because you have forsaken the eternal, he has also forsaken you. So, you know, he's telling them, you're in trouble, and you probably are beginning to see the trouble. And obviously when people see trouble, they don't want to say, well, it's because we're sinning. They want to find every other reason other than that. And if you tell them you're in trouble because you're sinning, they don't want to hear it. So rather than change, they will suppress you. In this case, martyrdom. And so once again, you know, they don't like the message. They kill the messenger. And once again, we see martyrdom. We see persecution of God's people. And we see a pattern all the way through the Bible of the righteous being martyred. That goes all the way through the Bible. It climaxes in a way with the perfect person. God himself in the flesh, Jesus Christ, is martyred. And that's the classic case, but all through the Bible we have martyrdom before and after Jesus Christ. And here we have an example. Now, if you're looking at the Bible as a whole, going from Genesis to 2 Chronicles, this is now the end of the Old Testament, pretty much. We're near the end. So the first martyr is Abel. And I want to say something about Abel. Let's go back to Genesis 4. I don't want to take too much time, but in a way, Abel was a religious martyr in a certain sense. Because remember, Abel brought an offering and Cain brought an offering. It doesn't say that Cain refused to bring an offering. Abel brought an offering, Cain brought an offering, and God was favorable to Abel's offering. So in effect, they were competing religions, you could say, or competing approaches to religion. Abel's and Cain's. And Cain couldn't handle the fact that God had chosen Abel. And so he destroyed Abel. Isn't that what you see in the history of religion? How dare you say you're God's people? We're God's people. And we're going to get rid of you. You know, that seems to be, you know, that's kind of the summary. So anyway, as you know, Cain murdered Abel. And you could say in a certain sense that it was a religious difference in a way. Because he brought an offering, Abel brought an offering, God was favorable to Abel's offering. Let's go to verse 10. I'm in Genesis 4:10. The poetry here is very powerful. And he said, what have you done? God speaking to Cain. The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Is this literal? No. It's not literal, but it's very powerful. And you'll see Revelation has similar imagery, which is also not literal, but powerful. And he said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." So this is the first martyr, and he's mentioned in the book of Hebrews. And Christ was the greatest of the martyrs, but martyrdom has occurred from Abel's time to Christ's time and then beyond to our time. And here we have the martyrdom of Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada. I'm going to read about it in verse 21. And the audacity of these people. So they conspired against him, and at the command of the king, isn't that terrible? At the command of the king, who had been taken care of by Jehoiada the high priest. So they conspired against him, and at the command of the king, they stoned him with stones in the court of the house of the eternal. So it would seem like what they were trying to do was to tell people, you know, this man is unjust, we're the righteous ones. And they even killed him in the court of the house of the eternal. And I realize I'm putting a spin on it that you don't have to accept, but just read the words, read what they did. That's bad enough. Now I want to talk a little bit about Zechariah. Zechariah is called here the son of Jehoiada. And as you know, the Bible can refer to the grandson as the son of somebody. In fact, sometimes in both in the Bible and in modern speech, a son is used as a descendant of somebody. You know, we talk about ourselves as this, we priests talk about ourselves as the sons of Aaron, for example. People call themselves the sons of some ancestor. They're not the literal sons, but they're the sons, after many generations. And I would think the son of Jehoiada might have actually been a grandson. Because if Jehoiada died at the age of 130, then he could have very easily outlived his own children. And by the time he's dead, it may be the grandson who came along and preached against the king. You follow what I'm saying? And so it was bad enough that he was martyred, bad enough to martyr a grandson of Jehoiada. But I'm saying it could be a grandson of Jehoiada who was martyred. Well, in that case, we don't know the name of his father. But maybe we do. So let's go to Nehemiah, the 12th chapter. Nehemiah, the 12th chapter. And here we have historical material, so I really should have stayed where I was. in the Bibles, let's go to Nehemiah. And in chapter 12, we come to the time much, much later in history. We come to the 6th century B.C., so we're several centuries later from where we started. Judah has been exiled, they've returned, and now we're in the Persian period. And I'm in Zechariah and Nehemiah 12, and I want to go to verse 12. Now in the days of Jehoiakim, so we're going back in history, so now we're back in the 6th century B.C., and at the time of the Babylonian captivity, okay? So we're going back. Nehemiah was there in the 400s. We're going back now into the early 600s, late 500s, to that period. We're backtracking. We're doing some history here. Is everybody with me? You haven't lost track of where we are? We're now at the time of the Babylonian captivity, at the time of Jehoiakim. Now, in the days of Jehoiakim, the priests, the heads of the fathers' houses, were of Zariah, Mariah, of Jeremiah, Hananiah, of Ezra, Meshulam, of Amariah, Jehohanan, and so on. And we're going to go to finally this is the time of Nehemiah. This is the time of Nehemiah. Because if we go back, we'll see that. I guess I should go back to the beginning of the chapter to set the time frame. All right, let's go back to Nehemiah 12, because I don't want to confuse you. Now, these are the priests and the Levites who came up with Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, Seraiah, and Jeremiah, Ezra. He was one of the ones who came back. He was a priest who eventually came back, and various priests are mentioned. So we are dealing with the period when they came back from captivity, and I want to go now to verse 16. And here is a priestly family of Edo. Okay? A family of Edo. And here is a man named Zechariah. So there's a priest named Zechariah who's from the family of Edo. And so it would seem like perhaps he was a son of Edo. Now, let's say that Edo had other children, because it's possible. We just see here the head of the household mentioned. Let's say Edo had other children. And let's say that Edo, for the sake of my argument, had another son and named him Berechiah, which means, you know, blessed of the eternal, or the eternal has blessed, rather, you know, Berechiah. Let's say he had named him that, all right? Let's go now to the book of Zechariah, and I'll show you where I'm going with this. So are we still all right? I'm saying that Edo had a son, Zechariah, but I'm saying it's possible he had another son and named him Berechiah. You still with me? So now let's go to the book of Zechariah, the prophet Zechariah, who prophesied during the Persian period, but before Nehemiah's time. So I want to go now to Zechariah. And in the beginning of the book, it gives his background. And here's what it says. It says, in the 8th month of the 2nd year of Darius, 520 B.C., the word of the Eternal came to Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Edo, the prophet, saying. Oh, so here we find that Zechariah is the son of Berechiah, the son of Edo. And what I think possibly happened is that Edo had a son, Zechariah, yes, and another son, Berechiah, and that very likely Zechariah, Berechiah's brother, died. So when Berechiah had a son, he named him after his brother. In other words, Zechariah was possibly named after his uncle. Does that make sense? That's what happened to me. My father gave me the second name, David, after his brother who died. So that means my grandfather, Meir, my first name is Mark, named after my grandfather, Meir, who died before I was born on my father's side. So Meir is my first name, and I'm named after my father. But Meir had a son, David, but also my name is David because my father named me after David who had died. So Meir had a son, David, and a grandson, David. I think that possibly is the situation here, that maybe Zechariah was named for an uncle. Now, why would Zechariah, there's a second reason why Berechiah would have named his son Zechariah. Not only because he had a brother of that name, but also to honor the father of Zechariah who was martyred. There was an earlier Zechariah who was martyred. And maybe his father was also named Berechiah. So the later Berechiah said, okay, my name is Berechiah. My brother Zechariah has died. To honor him, I'm going to name my son Zechariah. But besides that, I'm also going to be honoring the Zechariah who was the son of Berechiah, who was martyred during the time of the king Joash. Why am I saying all this? I'll tell you in a moment. So let's first backtrack before I go any farther. We have Zechariah back in the 9th century. Not the prophet, but an earlier prophet who was martyred. And this is the last official martyr of the Old Testament history. This is the book of 2 Chronicles. It's the end. Who was the first one? Abel. Who's the last one? Zechariah, the son, or perhaps grandson, possibly, of Jehoiada. And how did they kill him? In a hideous way, as it says here. So they conspired against him. I'm back in 2 Chronicles 24:21. They conspired against him at the command of the king. They stoned him with stones in the court of the house of the Eternal. Thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness which Jehoiada his father had done to him, but killed his son. And as he died, he said, the Eternal look on it and repay. There is no way to make up for the martyrdom of God himself. Jesus said, forgive them, for they know not what they do. But in this case, he said, you know, this guy was taken care of by my father or grandfather, and now they're martyring me for telling them the truth. And he said, repay them. And that's what's going to happen. Just as when the martyrs have been martyred in other centuries, they've said, how long? How long? Before we, you know, you come and intervene, right? As we'll see in a moment. So he said, as he died, the Eternal look on it and repay. Verse 23. So it happened in the spring of the year that the army of Syria came up against him, and they came to Judah and Jerusalem and destroyed all the leaders of the people from among the people and sent all their spoil to the king of Damascus. So in effect, what happened to them is what happened to the Jews who conspired against Jesus Christ. A generation later, many of them were still alive, and they got to see the destruction of their temple, of their city. They got to see their nation rescattered a generation after. This is what happened here, although it probably didn't take that long. Well, it says in the spring of the year, so very soon after he was martyred, it happened. Spring, as you know, is wartime in the Middle East. Let's continue. For the army of the Syrians came with a small company of men. So in other words, you wouldn't think that they'd win, but God worked it out that they won. But the Eternal delivered a very great army into their hand, because they had forsaken the Eternal God of their fathers, so they executed judgment against Joash. And you'll find later that he was assassinated, and he was killed in the city of David, but not given a prestigious place of burial. So he met a violent end. Although that dynasty of David continued, his son reigned, but he was assassinated. So he only lived to be 47, evidently, right? He became king when he was 7, and he reigned 40 years, and he was murdered. So before he was 50, he was a victim of assassination, after he had, of course, executed a righteous prophet of God. All right. Now I want to go to Matthew 23 and put it all together. Well, this doesn't quite put it all together, but we're on our way. All of it on the future of God. you know, commanded festival coming up. Annual festival is the Festival of Trumpets. And so it pictures this time of judgment coming. But as I said before, this time of judgment, it comes in a sense as a response to martyrdom of the church. And therefore, it comes after the church has made such a significant impact that persecution sets in. Which means what? There will be a major, significant Church of God existing on the earth shortly before the coming of Jesus Christ. And the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man hid themselves in the caves and the rocks of the mountains and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? We as God's people will be able to stand. And in fact, if we're alive at that time, many, many around the world will share our beliefs and practices. There will be a major, significant impact of the Church of God shortly before the return of Jesus Christ. I would like to go to Matthew 24 and verse 14 in conclusion. Matthew 24 and verse 14. In Revelation 10, God's church is told to go again after seemingly the cycle is completed. Seven thunders have sounded. The church is told to go again. And in Revelation 11, two witnesses are called to do that final warning. And evidently they have a tremendous impact to where they are martyred, as so many others will be at that time. They themselves are martyred, but miraculously resurrected at the return of Christ. But remember, before all that happens, as I said before, the church once again has to have an impact greater than ever, I would say, greater than ever. Because the impact in the first century was basically localized. And then even then localized. It was basically regional. First in the land of Israel, then around the Mediterranean basin, let's say. But now it will be worldwide in its impact. So let's go to Matthew 24:14 in conclusion. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. So I've given you all of this history and all these technicalities to just make a comment about the future of God's church. And that is that God's church will be very great and very significant shortly before the return of Jesus Christ. Well, I thank you very much for listening. I didn't set dates. I didn't tell you when. I just made a comment about what is yet to come. I hope that will be encouraging. And in the meantime, we can do our best to keep the truth, you know, to preserve the truth and to spread it, you know, and to do as best we can. So again, I thank you for your prayers and your support. And I'm sorry that about the late start, but we did have a full discussion today. And many of you, I think, are listening live who would have listened at 2. You came back at 3 or hung around. And maybe some of you, as I said, thought it was a 3 anyway. Well, from here on out, though, it normally will be at 2 o'clock Eastern time, which means 11 o'clock on the West Coast. So thanks again for listening. We have a new month coming up tomorrow, so in a new week coming up. So may the Sabbath day be a very blessed time for you, and may the new month be a blessed month for you and the new week. And let me say to Canadians, July 1st is coming up. My mother was born on July 1st, but what's more important to Canadians is that Canada was born on July 1st. So we salute the Canadians who listen, or even those who don't. All the best to our brothers up in Canada, brothers and sisters up in Canada. And the 4th of July is when the United States was born, not as the Canadians. Our personality is different. You know, we were born in rebellion, not like the way the Canadians did it. We'll be commemorating the beginning of this country on July 4th, which would be this coming Friday. So we hope that if those of you who are perhaps vacationing at that time, that can all go well. All the best to you and yours.